I'm here with Debbie Heath, and this time I'm not going to be talking with her about a book that she's chosen, but a book that I've chosen. So the onus is on me. And I was thinking, because she asked me why I chose this book or how I came to choose this book, I was actually looking back at the winners of the Man Booker Prize over the last few years, and I realised that actually we hadn't covered any of the authors who won that prize.
Right.
Since then, we've dealt with Hilary Mantel, because, of course, Wolf Hall won and then Bring Up the Bodies won, and she has yet to produce her third volume, which will probably go on and win a prize as well. So we've dealt with that one. Camilla Chester came in and talked about Hilary Mantel and those books. And I looked at the others and I thought, well, I know Peter Carey, I know a few other ones. I don't know anything about this one. George Saunders, Lincoln in the Bardo. And I thought, well, that's a very strange title for a start. When I got the book and I looked at it, I thought, crikey, what have I done? Because it is a very strange layout. I mean, it starts with 2.5 pages or thereabouts of a sort of a monologue by one character, but it then immediately shifts into what becomes standard throughout the book of a series of extracts from, well, there are two types of things. There's the historical side, because we are talking about President Lincoln.
Yes.
Abraham Lincoln. We're talking about, there's no surprise in this, I'm not giving anything away. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the sickness and then death of his young 11-year-old son, Willie, and the sadness that that brings, obviously, to Abraham Lincoln at a time when he is involved in the early stages of the Civil War, and people turn on him for this reason and say, you know, you don't understand all the people that are dying because of you, who pursued the Civil War, as it were, in order to free the slaves. It was more complicated than that, I admit. But in the sections that are dealing with the historical context, where we're looking at what was going on, it was in the White House, not the White House as we know it today, with the building that was there then, and there are extracts from other books.
The terror and consternation of the presidential couple may be imagined by anyone who has ever loved a child and suffered that dread intimation common to all parents, that fate may not hold that life in as high a regard and may dispose of it at will.
In Selected Civil War Letters of Edwin Willow, edited by Constance Mays.
So it's building up a theoretical story of the actual facts. Lincoln and his wife in the White House. There's a party, major, one of the great parties in the White House. At that time, his son is upstairs, effectively dying. And you get all sorts of historical extracts that describe that situation. And then it switches, and gradually, the switch takes over to the graveyard, where there are characters of whom we know nothing other than what they tell us, and they are in what is called the Bardo. This is in the Bardo. It's like purgatory. It's like the limbo land. It's between death and moving forward beyond death into the next world. And they aren't there. They're stuck in this spirit land, which is where young Lincoln is in the beginning. And the characters develop. They've got various characteristics, and there are lots and lots of them. It's an audiobook with 16 different actors. I think some of those 16 are doing more than one voice as well, because there are lots and lots of different characters that come pouring in. And it builds a wonderful picture. This is rather less a discussion than a monologue at the moment. I'm going to stop in a moment. It's not a fantasy. It's fantastical. It's magical. I became totally engrossed by it. I thought when I looked at it at first, I can't cope with this. It looks so odd. How can you read a book which you may get three lines and then a quote and then three lines and then somebody says where that's come from? And so the whole thing just, for me, builds and builds and builds. I couldn't put it down. And listening to the audiobook, which I found even more magical, although it has disadvantages, which we can perhaps talk about, the comparison between the two, I found that just rolled along. I mean, it feels like it goes on forever, and yet it doesn't. It's actually quite short by comparison with many books. That's why I picked it.
Okay.
Now, what did you make of it?
Well, it's really interesting. This is the first time I've seen the book. Obviously, I can't read the words, but I can see how it has been laid out. And I can tell you there is no way I would have read it ordinarily. But I can't see properly, so it all has to be done by audio. And that's a blessing and a curse. One of the difficulties is that sometimes an audiobook, which I listen to through my iPod, you don't get a blurb. You don't really know what it's about. So all I knew was this was a book definitely about Abraham Lincoln, not a historical political figure I was particularly interested in, but I thought, I'm interested in history, let's give it a go. And it was very confusing to start with, but once I got into the swing of it, I thought, well, this, I don't know how it would work as an actual book, but it does work well as an audio book because you've got different voices telling the story. So a bit more interesting than a standard biography format. And it allows you to see things from more than one perspective. And I really like that in biography. And biography, autobiography, it's a tricky genre, really, because certainly autobiography is entirely biased, isn't it? Is it fact? Is it what the author would like you to think of their life? I mean, Brian Blessed's autobiography is absolutely hilarious. I love Brian. So this is interesting because I think it allows you to get a very rounded picture.
You talk about biography and autobiography. I had never really thought of it as biography. I thought of it as it's a work of fiction. That's what it is.
Mm.
But it includes biographical details.
Yes.
About Lincoln and about the environment. But within those details, there's often contradictions because some of the sources quoted, I mean, I'm thinking of one section where it says, well, that big party during which the son was lying upstairs ill and he was going to die very soon. And the parents, Abraham Lincoln and his wife, were popping upstairs, down. Downstairs, upstairs, downstairs. Afterwards, various people said,
in several accounts of the evening, the brilliance of the moon is remarked upon.
In Long Road to Glory by Edward Holt.
A common feature of these narratives is the golden moon, hanging quaintly above the scene.
In White House Soirees, an anthology by Bernadette Yvonne.
There was no moon that night, and the sky was heavy with clouds.
Wicket opposite.
And you think, hang on, this is the way biography works. Because what the author is doing is drawing on a multitude of sources. I mean, some of them are unpublished notes and diaries from servants who worked at the White House at the time. And putting all those together and coming up with a multifaceted picture, and you don't quite know what's true and what isn't true.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter because it's within a context that itself is fictional.
It's really clever, isn't it? It's a structure that is, it's intriguing.
You could easily give up after one section or less listening to it. You think, crikey, I'm not going to get a run at this. It keeps interrupting by saying where that bit's come from, where that bit's come from. That sort of goes off after a while. In the beginning, with these characters who are in limbo land, you have to have them identified because you don't really know who they are. Otherwise, there are two or three of them. There's the Reverend Science, and there's I forgot the names, Bevins and something else, who are all there in this dreadful period, but they don't want to move on into the other world, the next world. They're stuck in this period of time, but they're also stuck there of their own volition because they could go, and we see during the book the situations where people do go, this magical flashing of light and everything else, and they go on. But they're very concerned about young Willie Lincoln because he should not be there for more than a very short time because children shouldn't hang around in the Bardo. They should go on. And they want to do everything possible to get him out of there, out of the sarcophagus in which he is sitting looking at his own body. They're not in coffins, of course. They're all in sick boxes. Wonderful phrase which they use because they will not admit to the fact they're dead.
Yeah.
They fell sick. They were put into a sick box. They were taken to this place. And they don't understand it almost why they're still there. Some of the characters that are stuck in this place are not very pleasant. I mean, some of them are quite offensive. Some of them are very offensive to each other, very painful, hurtful to each other, bringing with them all sorts of problems. And I think that's what's so interesting is that every character brings from the real world the history.
And that day, alas, was the day of the beam. Yes, yes, what luck. A beam from the ceiling came down, hitting me just here, as I sat at my desk. And so our plan must be deferred while I recovered. Per the advice of my physician, I took to my... a sort of sick box, was judged to be...
Hans Vollmann.
Efficacious.
Roger Bevins III.
Efficacious, yes. Thank you, friend.
Always a pleasure.
There I lay, in my sick box, feeling foolish in the parlor, the very parlor through which we had recently, gleefully, guiltily, her hand in mine, passed en route to her bedroom. Then the physician returned, and his assistants carried my sick box to his sick cart, and I saw that our plan must be indefinitely delayed. What a frustration!
The mother who had three daughters, who she talks about them endlessly, and they float around as orbs. Mm. And then one day, the characters that we are most often with in the Bardo, they realise those orbs are empty, and they realise that the mother has actually gone on to the next world. And sometimes there's a sort of a huge event. There's like a wind howling, and then a rushing of water, and that means there's another gang of them coming from somewhere else, and these are spirits attacking. It sounds very odd.
It is odd, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because so many books are about about ghosts, children, often, who are stuck between worlds. And I think this is the first book I've read that explores that other world. I don't know. This is a deep question, really, Rob. Do you think that's possible? I wouldn't rule it out. I don't know.
No idea. We all have different concepts of what might happen after we've died. Yeah. But the idea of purgatory and limbo has been quite common throughout history. Mm. It's still there now, this idea that there is something between life and full death, as it were. Mm. And that can be a formative moment, that you either go one way or t'other. But this is done in such a human way. There is a lot of humour in it as well, yes. Of course. Some of the characters. They sort of, you know, they're on the make. There are crooks and there are villains, and they remain that way. And that's why they're dead in many cases. I mean, one of the characters is there because a beam fell on his head just as he was about to go back to his wife. But he thinks, at that point, he thinks, I'm only in a sick box. I'm going to get better. They just put me in a sick box because that's what they do. But it's because we know he's dead. It's a coffin. Young Willie is there, and if he sits still for too long, then the arms, well, like the roots of trees, will come round him and they will seal him into this sarcophagus unless he's got out. And the other three characters that are running around here trying to look after him actually break him out of that several times by forcing these tendrils, or whatever the right word is.
My father was here and has promised to return, the boy said. I am trying to last. All best wishes with that, said Mr. Lippert, raising an eyebrow. Mind your leg there, kiddo, said Mr. Kane. Distracted by our guests, we had been remiss. The boy's left leg was now webbed to the roof by several stout new tendrils, each the width of a wrist. Goodness, the boy said, blushing. The labor required to get him free was not insignificant, roughly equivalent to that required to uproot a tangle of blackberry roots. He bore the considerable discomfort of that procedure with a soldierly fixity of mind for one so young, letting out only a stoic grunt at each tug, and then, exhausted, fell back into that earlier state of disassociated torpor.
The spirit of him, not the body, because that's still there in the sick box. And when Lincoln comes back to the graveyard, very, very sad and very tragic, and that's, again, historically true, that he did go and apparently would sit by the grave of his son. These three characters, they lead us through the Bardo all the time, that the Reverend and his two friends, who are there for different reasons, they try to get Lincoln to get his son to go on, to move on. And the only way they can do that is to enter into him.
In order to occupy the greatest percentage of the gentleman's volume, I lowered myself into his lap and sat cross-legged, just as he was sitting.
The two now comprised one sitting man, Mr. Volman's great girth somewhat overflowing the gentleman, his massive member existing wholly outside the gentleman, pointing up at the moon.
It was quite something. Quite something in there. Bivens. Come in, I called out. This is not to be missed.
I went in, assuming the same cross-legged posture.
And the three of us were one.
So to speak.
There's Lincoln sitting, and one of them climbs into his lap and goes into it, and the other one climbs onto his lap and goes into it. So there are three of them in the same body, and they're trying to communicate in some way with Lincoln to get his son to go on. To let his son be dead, because Lincoln doesn't want his son to be dead. And that's part of the trick, I think.
Yeah, it's so sad, isn't it? One can't help identifying with that. I mean, we're both parents, aren't we? And focusing on that part of the book, it's a very, very sad book. And it's not what I thought the book would be about, because I hadn't read the back. I certainly didn't know it was going to go off on this magical mystery tour. Now, this is where you're at an advantage reading a book. When you're listening to a book, you get distracted easily, you see. And I did, cooking the dinner, walking along, seeing someone I know. And it's really hard to pick up again. So I didn't get everything from this book that you got.
I've listened to it in the car on long journeys. So I've listened to it in bits as well. And that I've noticed, that I've lost track of where I am. I didn't find that a disadvantage. And that may be because I'd read the book first, as it were. But I felt that it almost didn't matter if you missed sections of it. Because the whole thing is so sort of compulsively multidimensional that it sticks with you, and you think, well, it didn't matter. I can't remember where I was. You're given these guidelines of the voice says, you know, it's not chapters, it's 35.
Yeah, that's true.
Some of them are very short. page or two long only. And then you're sort of led through it. And I don't think it matters too much. It isn't as if it's a long narrative which you miss bits of, because it's actually lots of different characters coming in with different elements and groups of characters. The men with the hats, I can't remember what they're called, and various other things, the wedding parties and all sorts of things that come in. You get a whole social context.
So what you mean, Rob, is it's a very confusing book, whether you read it or not.
I don't think it's confusing. I don't think it, well, okay, maybe I'm a peculiar sort of reader. Yes. but I like challenge. Yes, I agree. It's not a book for everyone. It's not an audiobook for everyone. But I honestly would say it is a challenging and ultimately fascinating and rewarding.
It is. I'm really glad I read it. Wouldn't have chosen to. Didn't know what I was getting into. And that's hard for sighted people to understand. Because if you go into a bookshop or a library, judgments you will make about really what the book looks like, the artwork, and maybe if you've read something by that author before. But we really do come into these things blind. So yeah, it wasn't what I was expected. It was a really interesting structure. I didn't learn very much about Abraham Lincoln, but of course that wasn't really the point.
Absolutely. It uses biographical details and questions them all the time as part of the context in which the real story, which is this child in the Bardo and all the things that are going on around that. Lincoln is important because he's the cause of it. And of course, he keeps dropping back into the Civil War and the context of what's going on within American life at that time.
As the dead piled up in unimaginable numbers and sorrow was added to sorrow, a nation that had known little of sacrifice blamed Lincoln for a dithering mismanagement of the war effort.
In The Unpopular Mr. Lincoln, the story of America's most reviled president by Larry Tagg.
The president is an idiot.
In The Civil War Papers of George B. McClellan, edited by Stephen Sears.
Vain, weak, puerile, hypocritical, without manners, without social grace, and as he talks to you, punches his fists under your ribs.
In The War Years by Carl Sandburg, account of Sherrard Clemens.
I think autobiography and biography are very interesting concepts, and I think it works really well having those different viewpoints rather than one. I mean, some biographers do use different sources, don't they? But I really like the voices in the audiobook. There are some wonderful speakers there. Nick Offerman with his lovely, rich tone.
So there's lots and lots of different voices. It really is challenging to listen to, just as it's challenging to read. Mm. It's his first novel, I believe, because he's a short story writer who's spent all his life writing short stories.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because I can see that now you mention it. It is a series of very, very short stories, isn't it? With a sort of theme.
A lot of people kept saying to him, when are you going to write a novel? When are you going to write a novel? Well, he finally did.
Well, I really like short stories, actually. I wish we celebrated them more. Mm. There's an amazing skill in being able to get interesting character development, good use of language and other literary devices within a very short story. Yeah. And I do think we should...
we should come back to short stories because it's very much in the moment. It's very popular at the moment. There is a sort of resurgence of short story writing at the moment. Great. George Saunders, not Sanders, not to be confused with the actor, George Saunders. This is George Saunders, winner of the Man Booker Prize 2017, the first American to win the prize. It's called Lincoln in the Bardo. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Lincoln in the Bardo was written by George Saunders. The audiobook, kindly provided to us by Caliber Audio so that we could take some extracts, was recorded by a total of 16 different actors. It lasts for approximately 7.5 hours. Well, I guess my enthusiasm about this book was pretty darned evident. Not an easy read, nor an easy listen, but well worth it for me.